have the pleasure of introducing Professor Richard Bonney, who's here from the University of Virginia. He kindly did not let the weather hinder his making it up here, and they had more snow than we did, so
he really
deserves some credit for battling the elements on this one. I've known him for a very long time, and I can say with some authority that he is probably the nation's leading authority on law and psychiatry. That will probably embarrass him mildly, but that's true. And he has joint appointments at the Virginia School of Law. I know he's got an appointment in the medical school. He runs an institute there, which I'll botch the name of, but it's Law and Psychiatry, and X. And he has been working most recently on state law reform in Virginia. And I told him that I would let him introduce that part of the narrative arc to you because he knows it far better than I do. This title is up behind my head, but I think we're going to hear quite a bit about developments in mental health law reform in the state of Virginia, partly in the wake of sad events at Virginia Tech. And I'll let him have the floor from here. Thank you again for coming.
My pleasure.
So to continue the introduction, law and psychiatry, I've basically grown up in the field of law and psychiatry. I mean, I think it basically has its roots, in the 60s and 70s. I've always been interested in the public policy aspects, as well as the very, very interesting and challenging ethical and constitutional issues. Institute's name, however, is relevant to what I'm going to talk about here because it's the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. I have been involved in formulating Virginia law and hoping over the years to use anything that we accomplished in Virginia that seemed like a good idea as a model to be used elsewhere. From the beginning, and relevant to what I want to talk about today, one of the, I think we've had a lot of successes in shaping, Virginia law, particularly in connection with forensic psychiatry and the criminal process. We haven't had as much success, I think, in connection with civil commitment and involuntary treatment through the legislature, although I think our work in the basically the human rights programs of the public mental health services system, have been useful. The experience in connection with civil commitment reform was in the early 1980s when we had done an empirical study, basically, of observations of civil commitment hearings and were sort of in the process of releasing that information. The basic finding, I think, probably won't surprise you, but they didn't last very long, I think is one way to put it, there were clearly wide variations in the procedures that were used by the different judges that were doing it, as well as some question about whether whatever the procedural rights that people were being assured were being provided to them. About the same time, there was a young legislator who had been a public defender and I think went into sort of a trial practice, was in the, as I said, in the legislature. He himself had gotten interested in this because he did some observations of hearings. And we ended up basically from that point, he convinced the legislature to establish a special study committee, and he and I basically were in charge of kind of, making this inquiry. To make a very long story short, this was over a couple of years, we ended up having the reform legislation that we had drafted passed by the House of Delegates. But when it got to the Senate, it lost basically on the floor by one vote. And the what got in our way was the cost of providing due process, basically. Due process, if you provide it, costs money. And they just didn't want to go there. And so that was kind of the end of that. And I sort of, spent time after that worrying about other things. But I'll provide a little bit of this background in the talk, but the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court had gotten interested in these issues because things had really gotten worse, not only in terms of some of these procedural and fairness issues, which is what really had focused our attention before, but on a lot of other problems. Almost every stakeholder group was upset, basically, about how involuntary treatment was being handled. And there were particular complaints about the commitment of the elderly, because whenever the commitment process was initiated, and someone needed basically transportation to the facility for evaluation, it was provided by the police. And whenever their standard practice, when they go pick somebody up, is to put them in handcuffs. And so you can imagine the horror of the families that were just pulling their hair out beside themselves, because often, I imagine, sort of, you know, combination of dementia and some of the emotional difficulties that people could have. And, you know, had no alternative but basically to try to seek help from the community services agency and to get somebody picked up. And there they would, the police would show up in marked cars and, you know, put them in handcuffs and stick them in. I mean, it was just horrifying. And of course, you can imagine the kind of complaints that would emerge from that. And the Chief Justice, I think, had, you know, his attention called to it. You got a million other problems, you know, the number of mentally ill in the jails and so on. So the Chief Justice is kind of positioned to kind of see what was going on. He decided that this was going to be something that he was going to kind of go beyond the normal sort of role of the courts to kind of see if we could do something about these problems. And he asked me to help him. And I was telling Art earlier, I said no, you know, been there, done that. I don't want to do that. And this takes a tremendous amount of time. And, you know, in order to get everybody on the, you know, around the table to build consensus, actually, to carry out these reforms, I mean, you can't leave these conflicts unaddressed. You have to basically get everybody around the table, and it takes a while, basically, to get everybody comfortable with what you're doing. And it's going to take a long time, and you have to be willing to make that kind of commitment. And then, you know, I don't know, of course, what the prospects would be at the end of the line, you know, given the experience we had in 1982. And at the end of the day, I mean, he basically came to Charlottesville and said, you know, we really need to do this, and so I did it. And I think we have accomplished some good, but I'm going to say a little bit about that now. So, I need to figure out a way how I'm going to get my outline here at the same time that I'm doing this. So, what I want to do is to set a little bit more of the stage by talking about the work of the Commission on Mental Health Law Reform, which I have been chairing. We started in 2006, and we're still going, but it'll be over in 2010. Then, after I do that, I think that's kind of a necessary background, and as Art said, part of the narrative arc of basically what I want to address sort of requires that we kind of go through this a little bit chronologically. Some of you have read an article, I think, in Health Affairs that I recently did on this, and a little bit duplicative of that. Then, what I want to do is to just reflect a bit on what is still an unfinished experience to try to see if I can extract some, you know, broader sort of themes and lessons that might be of interest to you a little bit going beyond what I did in summer camp this summer, right? I mean, let's see if we can think about, you know, some of the lessons learned. There are two headings for these, and I'll just kind of give you a little bit of a introduction to it. This is a highly conflicted field. I mean, I've already indicated that in the experience that I described to you, and I think you probably are aware. You know, a lot of issues, just kind of, you know, mandatory outpatient treatment or outpatient commitment is just a highly debated issue across the country. It's a fighting issue, you know, among people in the field. So you think of this as a conflict issue, a real clash of values between, you know, paternalistic sort of approaches to this and libertarian approaches. What I want to say to you is there is a lot less conflict here and a lot more consensus than you might otherwise think from reading the papers and seeing these debates. Secondly, you'd think people have been thinking about this for a long time, at least since the 1960s, and, you know, this is, you know, certainly developed a life of its own, this field, and a lot of reform and a lot of legislation and a lot of regulation, you know, since that time. Before that, nobody paid any attention, basically. And you'd think all the field had been plowed by now. But what I want to suggest to you is that there's still a lot of unexplored territory, and I think that I was not aware of when I started this 3 years ago, there are new issues to address. The third, the thing, what I would like to do after just making a few comments about that is to close with more specific comments about one of the more exciting reforms, I think, that we have adopted basically in the 2009 session of the General Assembly. And it was a revision of our Healthcare Decisions Act, with which I'm sure anybody in bioethics is familiar with the structure of those acts, to specifically authorize advanced directives in mental health care. There have been some interesting puzzles that I think we have kind of tried to address, and I think it will be an important vista for certainly for us in Virginia and in other states. All right, so the background, as I've indicated, is that the commission was established, was conceived basically in 2005. It was the summer of 2005 when the Chief Justice made the visit I described to you. Widespread and growing dissatisfaction, as I've indicated, with the operation of civil commitment and increasing criminalization of people with mental illness. The complaints about the commitment process, as I've indicated, came from all stakeholders. There was no one that was satisfied with this process. We did focus groups and qualitative interviews with all the various stakeholder groups. There was also a conference that we had assembled. I think one and a questionnaire that was sent out at the conference was something along the lines of, are you satisfied with the existing civil commitment process? And of course, nobody was. What are the three basic problems, the most important problems that you that you have with the process or that need to be changed? And of course, there were a lot of complaints, and they were all different, right? Among all the groups, and this was really noteworthy. So just to give you the flavor, I don't want to go into too much detail about the law and the particular procedures in Virginia, but this is really just for taste and flavor. Can everybody over here see this? The process of emergency evaluation, which is initiated by an emergency custody order, is the kind of order that I just referred to. You call the police can come pick somebody up. You get 4 hours. Basically, for under that order, and part of what's supposed to happen then is our community services agency, emergency services, evaluates the person. If after that 4 hours they determine that there's probable cause to believe that the person meets the commitment criteria, they're then held under a temporary detention order. Hearing is supposed to be held 48 hours later. The emergency custody process was a subject of criticism because it was too short. The difficulty was finding a bed if you were going to do the temporary detention order, which I'll just call the TDO. If you were going to do that, you had to find a bed. You could imagine the possibility that you might have the 4 hours and it might elapse and you haven't been able to find a hospital that will take an involuntary patient because of the general issues about shortages of beds that come up from time to time. This transportation, the law enforcement didn't like it because they didn't want to be in this business, providing transportation. They were forever saying, basically, of course they have to respond. It comes out of the general budget. Nobody's paying for transportation. And they objected to it horribly. And of course, the longer the ECO process went on, the more they had to wait, right, while the evaluation was being done. Tremendous pressure on the emergency departments from this whole process of emergency evaluation, people in crisis. The procedures, everybody had objections to the procedures that were being used, and as I said, from both families that wanted to get people committed and patients that didn't want to get committed, didn't matter. They didn't like it, the process. Of course, the people that were doing it, inadequate fees, inadequate reimbursements, and then variations in interpretation of the law across the state, both in the procedures that were used and what kind of evidence was admitted and how formal the judges were, wide variations across the state. The law was being interpreted in different ways. Substantively, there were lots of concerns in some parts of the state about unduly restrictive interpretation of the criteria, the kind of the usual cry that, you know, we have, you know, this family member that really, really needs treatment, and, you know, we finally kind of just crossed the hurdle of calling somebody to try to get them the help that they need, and they go and they get evaluated and they get released, right, because they don't meet the commitment criteria. And the particular, one particular focus of this was the requirement under the law at that time that you had to be imminently dangerous to yourself or others. And of course that does raise, you know, important sort of ethical and constitutional questions about commitment criteria. So that was a major bone of contention, obviously. Lack of coordination among the players. Nobody talked to each other, you know, at the state level, at the local level, the mental health services people, you know, did their job. The, you know, courts sort of had their procedures and did their job. There was no coordination whatsoever as to what was going on. And of course, everybody basically said, there's nobody in charge, you know, of this process. And that's true. There was nobody that was in charge. And so everybody, you know, you have the cross systems problems that you often have. That I've just described, but you also had this highly localized process because it was different everywhere, right? And nobody was in charge. And I'm a lawyer, so one of the ways that you think if you've got variations in the way the law is being administered, you think there's got to be somebody, at least with regard to the legal questions, put aside the practice and programmatic issues here, you know, somebody's got to be in charge because we have a Supreme Court. There has never been an appeal to the Supreme Court of Virginia. There is no case law, there is no decided law at all, because this is basically a localized process that you not only, you know, have the lowest level, I don't mean that in a, only in a hierarchical sense, right? The judges who are actually doing this at the ground level, there's no appeals of anything that they do to anyone, because of course it's kind of over, you know, a person particularly with short hospital stays. I mean, they're just, you know, what's the point of appealing anyway? And also, these judges, by the way, are just lawyers who were appointed to do this job on a per-fee basis. They're, you know, so again, you have this issue about fees and complaints. So everybody had this complaint. So that's, again, some flavor of the commitment process. Just to give you some sense of the scale of this, I just want to give you some numbers. We did, there was no data. That's another thing. So here's this process that's going on. The Chief Justice was going around giving speeches about how many civil commitment cases there were in the state. And he based the numbers that he was given on the only data that existed anywhere in the state, which was the payment database in the Supreme Court to pay the lawyers and the special justices that did this work. And somehow they had assembled some number, even though the same database supported the independent clinical examination that has to be done in this process, the special justices and the attorneys, and indeed money was actually paid for the hospitalization, so you had to pay the doctors in the hospital. You had all these payments that were basically coming out of the involuntary commitment fund, and they just tried to figure out from that how many of these there were. Well, it wasn't even close. You know, he was giving, you know, speech, I think he said there were 50,000, you know, commitment hearings or something like that in the state. Well, so finally, when we basically took 1 month, asked the special justices to fill out a form in every case that they actually heard, right, so we could make an estimate of that particular month. It was May of 2007. We also asked the Community Services Agency to fill out something on every emergency evaluation they did. And so that gave us the kind of sense of the scale of these problems. And now, of course, we have put a database, you know, in place, and so I will give you some benefit of what we've learned from that. Okay, so the scale. About 50,000 crisis contact evaluations conducted by the community mental health agencies every year. That is not all of them, because those are the ones that the community services agency has to get involved in. They do have to get involved by law on any case in which a temporary detention order is sought, right? Because they are the gateway to the commitment process, and the reason that they're the gateway to the commitment process is the legislature wanted them to be the gateway to the state hospitals too, because this is also designed to keep people out of the state hospitals. So, but of course there are plenty of other emergency evaluations that are done by physicians, that are done by, you know, emergency, you know, departments that sort of don't get connected to this process. So, you know, that number we still don't know. About 5,000 of those involve children. About 10,000 of these people that are evaluated, 20%, are in police custody when the evaluations are conducted. Almost 50% involve people who are not currently in treatment. Now, I want you to think about this. This is, you know, a given month, you know, and again, we're just assuming this is a representative month, that people are presented in crisis, and 50% statewide are not in services, are not receiving services. Of course, there's tremendous variation in across the state, in the localities, as to what percentage it is. As I said, it ranges from a third to two-thirds, you know, in the different community services agencies. More than 40% of these people have no insurance, not even Medicaid, right? No insurance. Most of the people who are, the 50,000, who are evaluated, accept treatment voluntarily, but about 40% of them, there's the TDO issued and the commitment process is initiated. Okay, so it's approximately 20,000 people per year. Right now, actually, our figures would suggest it's probably maybe 22,000-23,000, you know, people per year. One question you should have in mind and you'd think about is, so is that a big number or is that a little number? Right? I happen to think it's a big number. I think it's way too many, you know, cases in which people could have been treated without invoking the civil commitment process, and we'll talk some about why. All right, in terms of the outcomes, about 80% of these proceedings, you know, the hearings held, and they result in hospitalization. In about 55% of the total, 55 of that that 80, there's involuntary commitments. So that's the commitment rate statewide of people who go to hearings, is 55%. 30% people have an option at the hearing to agree to voluntary conversion to voluntary status. So we're, as I said, right now the number back in June, May of 2007, it was 50-30, it's probably about 55-25 now. In terms of the voluntary, and so, and I think that I want to say a word about that later. Mandatory outpatient treatment. We actually had mandatory outpatient treatment, as every state does, as a less restrictive alternative for people who are meet the commitment criteria, the inpatient commitment criteria. We knew it was rare. It was about 5% of the cases in that month. And of course, highly localized. There were some places that used it and some didn't. You might actually remember it if you followed the Cho case at all. This was the issue with regard to Cho, is that he had gotten committed to outpatient treatment. One of the few, it was kind of shocking, you know, with those of us that knew this was hardly ever done, you know. And the bottom line is he did not meet the commitment criteria, okay. But the next morning, you know, he wasn't suicidal. And so, you know, the judge probably should have let him go. But he obviously was, you know, looked like he probably could use some help, right? So he said, you know, why don't you go to the Cook Counseling Center at Virginia Tech, and you know, I'm committing you, you know, to outpatient treatment. There's an interesting story here. Maybe we can follow it up in later on. One of the things that happened in the legislature in 2007 is that, you know, and this had been our agenda before anything happened with him, to kind of make the mandatory outpatient treatment process more specific in terms of, you know, what should be done and whose role it was, you know, to follow these things up. It was one paragraph in the code before, you know, that if the judge finds that it's a less restrictive alternative, you can commit somebody to outpatient treatment, and nothing to, you know, whose responsibility is it? It was just nothing in there. And what do you do if the person doesn't do what they're supposed to do, and blah, blah, blah. Nothing. Zero. Who's monitoring it? We got 10 pages in the code now on this. But it's not being done, right, anywhere. Now it's like 0.5%, right, is what's happening. All right, the rest of the cases, about 15% then, it's probably about 18% now, are dismissed. And so I'll say a little bit more about that later. Okay. Now, I've been focusing on civil commitment, but I don't want you to think that this whole thing was about civil commitment. And maybe in the big scale of things, that the bigger problem is all the mentally ill people that are in our jails. And there is, as I've said here, widespread despair. And I think despair is not too strong a word. about avoidable criminalization of people with mental illness. In Virginia, as I think nationally, the estimate, reasonable estimate, I think, is about 15% of the jail population has serious mental illness, about 45% of the children in delinquency detention facilities. One of the things that I wanted to do as we were going about this work, partly for persuasion and rhetorical purposes, but also to give people a sense that they were being heard, is whenever I was out on the hustings talking about what we were doing, to invite people to kind of write their story, you know, because everybody would get up and let me tell you, you know, what happened, you know, blah, blah. I said, you know, send me your story, and anybody you know, right, in your organization or whatever, get them to write it out, you know, and send it to me. You know, I mean, I have a book, you know, that thick. You know, I don't know how many it is, maybe 300 or 400 of these. And, you know, I have to admit, I haven't read all of them, and I haven't done anything with them, except, you know, I did get it out, you know, when I was preparing a talk like this some years ago. And I started reading them, and the number of them that had to do with the criminal justice system was amazing to me. I tried hard to get, you know, my son help. And I went to the community services board, and they said he wasn't committable. And, you know, he agreed to go to treatment, and then he didn't go. You know, they did another time, you know, swore at a DDO, and, you know, the judge let him go. And, you know, or maybe he got committed, and but he was out after 3 days. And he was continuing to deteriorate, and then, you know, he broke into somebody's house, or he did this or that, and he ended up in the criminal justice system, and we can't get him out, right? And this goes on, he spends time in jail, and then, you know, he goes out and he breaks, you know, probation, whatever, he gets put back in jail. Where clearly, I mean, just the story is, this is a seriously mentally ill person that needed help when he needed the help. And so one of the manifestations of, you know, deterioration and crisis is sometimes the criminal behavior, and these people are ending up, now they're not all like this, but these are the stories. And one after another, the complaints were about criminalization. So why can't we prevent this, right, is the, you know, the issue. And that's why I said, well, I keep talking about civil commitment because that's all this got started. But the criminalization, you know, problem and the need to kind of divert people and to provide services when you, whatever it is, you know, to prevent those things from happening, but even when they do happen, you know, is absolutely critical. Now, another thing that came up all the time was that, you know, families, and particularly of children, teenagers, need to seek judicial assistance to get access to mental health services. Now, maybe some of you heard about these problems too, because sometimes you have to give up custody, you know, of your children in order to be able to qualify, you know, for mental health services. And so the juvenile judges are absolutely all lined up trying to help, you know, to reform these laws, because they are the ones that are basically the gatekeepers to services. Right, I mean, they have the authority basically to order, you know, people to give services, and sometimes, you know, again, as I said, just because of the way the law is shaped, you know, you know, everybody feels at the end of the day, the only place that you can go is to go to court and see if you can get the help of the judges. So that's obviously not the way that it should be. So you got all this frustration, all this despair, okay? That's why you can see what the narrative, you know, arc is of this. This is amazing, all these complaints. Okay. So the Chief Justice convened this planning group. A lot of what I've told you kind of arose out of our work to develop the charge for the commission. And I think you can see from what I have said here, the more that we talked, right, and I mean, that was the plan that I had. We just had to get some of the core stakeholders and the Commissioner of Mental Health and the Inspector General and the judges and everybody around the table and just talk through these problems. So when we got started, that we would have our goals in mind explicitly, and we ended up with 5 pages of goals, that each task force would be assigned, these are the things that we want you to address. And so we spent a lot of time trying to do the work up front, right? And this is one of the things that I had learned, you know, from, and of course the problems were much worse than they were in 1980s from the last time around. And as I've said here, it became apparent that every single one of those problems that I've described to you is to some extent attributable to gaps in mental health services and community mental health services. Too many people with mental health problems are not getting the help they need when they need it to prevent the crisis in the first instance or to ameliorate the crisis before it spirals out of control. And even after the does spiral out of control are not getting the help that they need after that either. And importantly, this is a commission on mental health law reform. So part of the issue that we had to address right from the beginning is, if this is about services, this isn't about law reform, right? I mean, the law needs reform, right? And we have a lot of ideas about doing that. But, you know, you can keep trying to reform the law, but you are not going to have an impact on solving these problems unless you solve the services problem. This is a commission established by the Supreme Court, you know, of Virginia. So this is immediately, you know, a bit of a dilemma that we had. Just to have pictures of this, so this is, you can pick this up in any Virginia, any, you know, state. So this is the average number of persons in the public mental health hospitals, hospitals over, you know, from 1950 to 2006. And so this is deinstitutionalization. Okay, that's probably not a bad idea, right? But you have to have services somewhere. So this is a comparison where Virginia has a particularly serious problem. In some respects, there may be a golden sort of lining in this, silver lining, right, in this. But obviously, many states have not established the community mental health services to sort of, you know, provide what is necessary as deinstitutionalization is going along. But you will see that if you looked at the state mental health dollars that are spent on services, you know, you can see the curve with the one with the X's, right, that goes up to 70%. Across the country, 70% of state mental health dollars are spent on community services and 30% on whatever state institutions remain. In Virginia, it's the reverse. Right, so the Virginia curve is the rectangles, and so that goes up to about 30%. That is, or 40%. That's the percent of the mental health dollars in Virginia that are spent on community services. The percent of state hospitals is 60%. So it's 60-40 hospital to community in Virginia, as opposed to 70-30 the other way around elsewhere. Now, of course, you know the problem here. The politicians won't close the hospital because of the jobs, right? So we continue to, you know, to make them better. I mean, look, I was chair of the State Human Rights Committee in, you know, Virginia for 6 years. And, you know, I know these institutions are better and have gotten better as time has gone on. I mean, there's still problems that come up, but mainly in the institutions for mentally retarded. I mean, I think the institutions for the mentally ill are much, much better, and many of them are smaller. I mean, they're downsized, but still, we shouldn't be spending 60% of our dollars, you know, on this. That money should be in the communities to try to fill these gaps in services. All right, so the studies that we did also documented the effects of these perceived service gaps, actual service gaps, on the crisis responses by the community services boards, including whether or not involuntary treatment was used in these emergency evaluations. I think the bottom line here is, you know, if the services were available to prevent the crisis, outpatient services, if you had better crisis stabilization alternatives to hospitalization, if you had intensive, you know, other types of intensive interventions, you could avoid this, you know, ECO, TDO commitment hearing business. That's why the number is just way too big, because crisis is being pushed toward hospitalization, number one, and to involuntary hospitalization, you know, number two. So based on some of the surveys that we did, there's poor access to immediate medication evaluation in many localities, lack of intensive crisis response alternatives to hospitalization, and lack of access to urgently needed outpatient services. Forget, you know, the continuum to go back, you know, more preventively. Even when you have urgent care that's needed, you can't get, the waiting list is just too long, right? I mean, people can't get the services that they need. Okay, so this leads to the goals. I mean, I've kind of summarized a lot of things we learned after the process was initiated. So here are the four components, basically, of the, and we had task forces, basically, that were addressing each one of these, as well as children. I mean, I'm not focusing on children here, but we had one that was kind of addressing all of this for children. So we need to enhance access to community services and supports. Access to services is the key to everything. Right, so we had a task force, and you know, I chatted with the Chief Justice. I said, "Look, this is not about, you know, law. This is about mental health services, and we have to have a task force. We have to address these issues." Okay, reform of the commitment process, civil commitment reform obviously is important, reduce criminalization of the mentally ill, and importantly, empower individuals with mental illness and their families to give them more control over the services that they receive. Now, there are a lot of reasons to do that, and that's obviously part of the mantra of the kind of recovery empowerment orientation. But what's really key for this is what I told you before about the fact that 50% of the people in crisis are not in services. You have to have a services system that not only provides the services that they need and has the capacity to provide the services that they need, but it's shaped to draw people into services by giving them the sense that they have choices and that they have control over the services that they receive. Empowerment is critical to this if you're going to draw people into services rather than having to push them into services, which is kind of where we are with this. All right, I want to come back to this slide in a minute. So the political strategy for doing this, I've said we've had this convening function. It was bipartisan, consensus building process. We had all the branches of government, all constituencies, commission, and five task forces. There were, there was a whole brigade, right, of people that were involved in this with all the task forces. We knew we had a public education effort. So part of, I had a discussion with the Chief Justice about sort of where we could get some money, basically to do some public education, you know, about this, to develop a little momentum so the legislatures would say, yeah, I mean, we agree that this needs to be done. The strategy basically was to mute the conflict issues, to keep everybody on the train with things that they agreed on, the need for access to services, the need for destigmatization, the need for the recovery empowerment sort of orientation, while finding the middle ground on some of these fighting issues about the use of coercion. So that was the game plan, is that we can, there'll be something in this for everybody, but, not everybody's going to be happy about absolutely everything, but there was a lot of things to agree on. Two-year work plan, so as I said, we kind of created these task forces in October of 2006. Two-year plan, after that. A lot of enthusiasm, everybody thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread because it took it out of the legislature and took it out of the executive branch and the judiciary, known for independence and, not having a stake in this, right? Everybody said that will get us where we need to get. So, they were all in favor of this. The only negative thing that we had, and fortunately I can tell you that this was, I think this has been, muted also, but boy, it was a big problem. I've already kind of alerted you to this. Legislatures, particularly on the right, separation of powers. What in the world is the judiciary doing our job, right? Because this is about access to services, and at the end of the day, it's going to be about funding. And that's funding priorities, and that's their job. It's not your job. And so when I would go out, Professor Bonney, why aren't you just talking about judicial procedures? This is about law and the judicial procedures for commitment. Where do you get off, doing these things? And this was a problem, right, that we kind of basically had to address. I won't tell you kind of how we did, but we kind of soft-pedaled it. And I think, as I said, I think now there's no money anyway. I mean, that's the reason they don't care about it so much. All right, so then the tragedy of Virginia Tech. And I think you can see that the Tech shootings called attention to some of the problems that we were addressing. The inadequacy of the evaluation process, right? People were not doing the job that they needed to do. They didn't have the information. They weren't doing a good job of trying to do an adequate clinical evaluation before the commitment process. That's what happened there. The law relating to mandatory outpatient treatment, I just mentioned. There were tremendous missed opportunities, okay, all through the commitment process, right? Not to mention all the things that happened at Tech that had nothing to do with the commitment process. But this was part of this problem of not having connected the dots that the Virginia Tech Commission identified quite properly. So it called attention some of the problems that we were studying and, of course, created momentum for law reform and for increased funding for community mental health services to do these evaluations and monitor outpatient treatment if it was needed to be done. The Virginia Tech panel, basically, I helped to shape the report that they did on the mental health part. So we were all kind of marching in tune here and present, their report and our report to the legislature. So obviously, this galvanized public support. It solved our public education problem. right? So there, then the problem was, well, obviously what they're into, we haven't done our work yet. I mean, I accelerated the commitment reform issues that we were already studying so that we could present something to them, you know, in January of 2008. But we were no longer going to have a package that was comprehensive. It was going to focus on the fighting issues, among other things, right? And it wasn't going to have access, and although we got some money out of them, and it wasn't going to have the empowerment agenda. So I was worried that there was going to be a problem here, and that they would think they'd solved the problem, that momentum would be lost for getting out of this what we wanted. But I think as it turned out, I think maybe it was a blessing in disguise, because what we did is to do the commitment reform part of this and it kind of sailed basically right through. It was, I would just say, we can come back and talk about this later, it was kind of a moderate, middle of the road position. We loosened the commitment criteria, we tried to strengthen the procedural protections for people, and we did not try to expand mandatory outpatient treatment, you know, beyond basically a less restrictive alternative for people who met the commitment criteria. Basically the argument being, until you create the outpatient services, don't talk about trying to expand mandatory outpatient commitment. In 2009, we went back. We had to postpone the access agenda again now because of the recession. So what we focused on the next year was the empowerment agenda. And important parts of that were families and the individuals with mental illness, to facilitate notification when that was what they wanted together, facilitate alternatives to law enforcement transportation. This is maybe the most important thing we've actually done, is to set up procedures that you don't, you know, findings can be made that you don't have to have law enforcement involved, alternative transportation providers, which can be families, and then, of course, advanced directives, which is, the way we saw it, was the legal foundation, basically, for the empowerment recovery orientation. All right, so now let me draw from that the two things that I wanted to mention. I think I've kind of indicated here why I say that there's a lot less conflict than you would think. These public fora that I mentioned, where people would get up and tell their stories, I've kind of given you one side, right? My son that committed suicide because he didn't get the treatment that he needed, my son that's in jail, or, you know, whatever. But of course, you have the other side. I mean, you have people who have been victimized, you know, by the commitment process, feel like that their dignity was completely demeaned, that nobody paid any attention to them, and in some cases that they felt that they were actually injured, right? That their physical condition was injured by the drugs that they were, you know, made to take or given over their will. And of course, objections to restraints and so on. So, you know, you go out and, you know, naturally, as soon as the issue is you're going to expand commitment criteria, you're going to expand, you know, the possibility of coercion, you have these contrasting narratives. I mean, it is part of the field. And they're no less painful by having heard them, you know, repeatedly. I mean, I can almost predict, you know, what is going to be said, but they're individual human beings, right, that are telling these extremely painful, you know, accounts, whichever side that they are on. So, we had to face these issues, but frankly, and particularly as time has gone on and we have involved all these people around the table, you know, with each other, you know, and we did the commitments thing, whatever we were going to do, we did it. I mean, the mandatory outpatient treatment issue keeps coming up every year, and, you know, we kind of pushed it off, and as I said, we can talk about that, but we sort of addressed that in 2008, and at that point, and that's why I said this was probably a blessing in disguise. That was all set aside. We were able to focus entirely in this next session of the General Assembly, when there was no money anyway, so we couldn't really talk about the access problems, you know, on the empowerment agenda. And as I said, I think we've got some interesting things that we accomplished with regard to advance directives. So people, I think generally speaking, were all on the same page with regard to the goals. And I want to go back to this slide that I swept by earlier, because I think it's important. So in the goals statement, and maybe this is an embellishment, you know, with my own rhetoric, but basically this is what it says. And everybody signs on to this. We want to reduce the need for commitment, and I've tried to indicate to you that I think the need for commitment can be reduced because it's being driven and created, you know, by these gaps in services and other types of judicial involvement, and prevent criminalization of mental illness by enhancing access to services to prevent crises or ameliorate them, and by drawing people into services in their own choice. Okay, system transformation is law reform. All right, so I think that's a key ingredient of our whole way of thinking about this. Everybody, of course, can sign on to that. We want to provide needed services in the criminal justice system. We want to redesign the commitment process so that it is more fair and more effective, right? And everybody can sign on to that. Coercion should be used as a last resort and only when necessary, right? Everybody can sign on to that. But when it is needed, it should be used, right? And when it is used, it should be used effectively and fairly and respectful of human dignity. So we're not, nobody's abolishing, we haven't got any constituency for abolishing the commitment law. So the problems that families have is that it's used, but it's too short, and it's not providing what people need. And they get out before they're stabilized, and then there's no services for them afterwards, right? So, you know, this everybody can agree on in terms of what the goals are. And there are a lot of specific implications of this, you know, that I've kind of mentioned, crisis stabilization alternatives, and so on. All right, so now, how much time do I have?
About
20. 20? Okay, well, I can probably get through what I want to say for sure in that period of time. So, all right. So, less conflict than you might expect. I'll give you one example. Just recent, right off the press. We're in the General Assembly right now on this. So, I mentioned before, we have a 48-hour period between the time that people are taken into custody and then the hearing has to be held. And during that period of time, you've got to do an evaluation of their condition, an adequate evaluation. Hopefully, you're collecting information. You know, we remove the barriers to information exchange and do an adequate job. And then maybe the treating clinician will actually talk to the person who's doing the independent evaluation. 48 hours is just too little, you know, for that. It's the shortest in the country, right? And we've known from the beginning of the reform that this was something that needed to be changed. Our blueprint in 2007 said, we think this is something that needs to be done, maybe, you know, 4 or 5 days. Okay, let's go for 4 or 5 days, and we're going to continue to study it, because this one would have fiscal implications. So we didn't want to go for it immediately. We wanted to study it, and we wanted to see. Now, my position on this has been all along, actually, it probably won't cost you money. Because what will happen is that if you give a longer period of time, people have a greater amount of time to stabilize. And then they can either be released in situations in which now, because it's only been 48 hours, they just get propelled, you know, into, you know, because a decision has to be made, you have to hold a hearing, they're either going to get involuntary committed or they're going to agree under the gun, you know, to voluntary hospitalization. So that's more days of hospitalization. So either they can be discharged by then, or they'll convert to voluntary because they've stabilized enough, and, you know, why, you know, have the cost of a hearing, you know, as well. And then average length of stay, probably over time across all these people, probably will be reduced, actually, if you would just elongate the period so you can do an adequate evaluation job. And as I said, you can reduce the need for coercion, you know, by doing this. So that, I think, is what would happen if you kind of went to 4 or 5 days. But of course, that's my hypothesis. I mean, you can't prove that, right? But actually, we tried to use the data because we've got a natural experiment, actually, that you can do in Virginia, because 48 hours is the period, but it can be 72 if it's over a weekend, or even 96. So we have natural variation, you know, in this. And so we have actually been able to do a study by linking up that data with the Medicaid data to show that actually what I claim to you is true, right? That you can actually, for every day that you extend that TDO period, you can basically reduce the number of commitments and the number of hearings, basically, that were held, and can increase the number of conversions to voluntary. You may not pick up all the days, so it actually may be that there's marginally an increase. But we're in the legislature now with 72 hours. At least get the 72, and we'll kind of get some data about it and see what will happen after that. So that, so there's, again, and by, oh, so what I wanted to say about why this is not a conflict issue. When we first started talking about this, the consumer advocacy groups were dead set against it, because they just say, what's going to happen if you make it 72, you know, 96, whatever hours you do, people are going to get held that whole period of time, okay, until the hearing is held. And they're not going to be discharged earlier than that. And so it's more loss of liberty, right? It's less liberty instead of more liberty, right, that's going to happen with this. And so they were opposed to it. Well, I had an email exchange with the most vociferous of these advocates, you know, this year, who said, I see you got your bill in, and actually I think maybe you were right, right, you know, about this. This probably, you know, will have the effect, at least there's a reasonable prospect that it would, and, you know, so. Now, that shows you, you know, how, you know, far I think we've come, basically, in finding, you know, the common ground on this. All right, now, but my, the next thing, as I said, is unexplored territory, right? Things. These issues, right, been talked about all this time. All right, well, let me tell you one. So I've indicated how localized this process is. And I think you can see kind of why, once you think about it, it's emerged that way, right, is that, you know, it's obviously a lot of natural variations in the state, you know, geographic rural, the rural and urban, and, you know, less, resources and less, you know, treatment alternatives naturally, you know, that are across the state. This is probably true in all states. And then you have basically, you know, this judicial process that is entirely local as well. And so people have their habits, right? The judges have their habits, the community services, everybody has their habits. And, you know, so practice varies. I mean, you know, in a way you think about it, of course they do. But the outcomes vary as well. Right, it's not only the process, that you could easily understand, but the outcomes vary in a way that is just, as I said, mind-boggling. Rates of dismissal, rates of involuntary hospitalization, and then the converse is, you know, letting people agree to voluntary hospitalization at the hearing rather than committing them involuntarily. The analyses that we've done indicates that these variations are not attributable to clinical differences among the cases. You wouldn't expect, really, that there would be that much difference if people kind of propelled to crisis, you know, in crisis to a TDO, right? There are screenings that go through, you know, go on in this, and nobody's trying to put, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to keep people out of hospitals, not put them in hospitals. So the financial incentives are you know, clearly in that direction. So you would expect the screening process not to produce really substantial differences in how sick people are, you know, how much they need the intervention across the state. To some extent, these differences are, and you would think, would be attributable to alternatives to hospitalization that are available in the jurisdictions. The more endowed, you know, jurisdictions certainly have more alternatives, and you're probably going to reduce the number of commitments, and the data do show that. But most of the variants, and this is my interpretation of this, okay, I can't prove it, it's just what seems to be the most logical alternative to the other two things that I've mentioned, is the differences in perspectives among these decision makers. The judges have very different ideas about what they are doing, right? Some, and again, this wouldn't be a surprise to you from the standpoint of, you know, just understanding, you know, people's ethical sensitivities and so on. Some people have a paternalistic orientation to this, and they think their job is to put people in hospitals. Right? Others are, you know, libertarian, you know, lawyer procedure due process sort of types, and they were going to follow the letter of the law. It's going to look as much like a criminal trial as it can. The other one is going to look as much like a juvenile, you know, the old style juvenile court in 1899. Right? We're here to help you. And they just don't think they're doing the same thing. Right, and we did surveys back in 1982. Right? Basically, that was the finding. I mean, you know, that people just have different attitudes about what the point of civil commitment is. One, some are more therapeutic, more paternalistic, and other ones are more libertarian and more due process oriented. So that's true for the judges. It's also true, I think, for the independent examiners, the people who volunteer to do this work. It's not, it doesn't pay them a lot, you know, that do this work. I think they just have different views about what they're supposed to be doing, and you can translate this into an interpretation of the law and of the commitment criteria. Yes, it will be interpreted, you know, so what does imminence mean? You know, now it says in the near future, right? I mean, what does that mean? And they're going to have different, you know, perspectives about this. The CSB examiners probably also have a difference in perspective of their own. It's not just a question of predicting what the judge is going to do. They probably have different perspectives on their own. And all of this, you know, I'm going to show you the data about the judges and how much they vary. But we also found the same thing about how likely it was that for a particular locality to seek a TDO. Okay, so here is the dismissal rates. As I told you, this is recent data. Okay, this is the first 6 months of fiscal year 2010, right? July through January. So this is 6 months of data, and the mean is about 18%, right? So right about there, right, is the mean. And what you'll see, of course, is that you've got this wide variation from zero. Okay, and this is, by the way, only the jurisdictions that have, I can't remember what the number it is, you know, for this period of time, you know, 100, 200 cases. So we haven't got the, you know, the little numbers out. This is, you know, this is probably what's going on. And it's every single month. It doesn't vary from month to month, the percentages, or from year to year. These are the same numbers that we have had since we first got the data in 2007, and then we've had 2008. This is what shows up every time. These people are doing something different. So you have zero in one jurisdiction and 88.6% dismissal rates, right, in another part of the state. And then, you know, you just have all this variation, right? Many, many way below the mean and many, you know, above the mean. So this is amazing to me, right? And we've actually called attention to this. We've said we've got to do something about this. We've got to at least, but that's actually an interesting issue to discuss, right? Is this a bad thing? You know, my sense is it is a bad thing, right? But you ask me, well, which point of view should be the one that the judges should have? You know, obviously that's an issue, right? But at least they need to be aware they are doing different things. And maybe, you know, there is a kind of consensus that you can build about kind of what is the, you know, the function of commitment and how should interpret these criteria and so on. And we don't have appellate judges to do that. So how are we going to do that? So that's an interesting question. How do you go about doing something about this? All right, and I have some thoughts about that, which maybe we'll have time to talk about. So involuntary commitment rate. So here's the reverse. So you have all the way from, 4.3% in one jurisdiction. The mean, as I said, is about here. It's about 55, I think. Okay, and so here's the place, 100%. I guess we would know, it's probably got to be the other, I don't know that it's the same jurisdiction as before. 100%, 94%, 82%, 80%, you know, that's the commitment rate, whereas the statewide average is in here. And then you have, you know, 4%, 7%, a quarter, you know, these people are not doing the same thing, right? Now, the missing piece of why it looks like that is the voluntaries. And so this is also very interesting. The judges have an opportunity at the hearing to say to people, do you want to go voluntarily? Right? Now, there will be a minimum period of treatment. I think it's 3 days that they have to agree to. But there won't be a commitment, and they can just say, okay. Right? So you would expect some variation in, you know, whether people agree to do this or not. But would the likelihood of agreement for people who have gotten this far in the process be likely to vary geographically, right? Or people in Norfolk more likely to agree to voluntary treatment than the people in Petersburg, right? Or whatever? Well, you wouldn't think that would be the variable, you know, that clinical condition and willingness to do this. So this has got to be the likelihood that the judges think that voluntary treatment is a good alternative to involuntary treatment, right? This is just a practice difference. And look at it. You know, I mean, the percentage, I think, now is about here. That's the mean. You know, it was 30% when we did the study in 2007. It's about here now. And, you know, you see all these, you know, cluster down here, and then you have these. I mean, they're just not doing the same thing, right, with regard to the likelihood that, you know, they will agree to offer and give people a chance to agree to voluntary treatment. All right, now, I think what I will do is to skip this privacy issue. It is fascinating, actually. Just a little teaser on this. Do you think that people, when they're subject to a commitment hearing, should have the opportunity to close the hearing? Maybe should the law require that the hearing be closed? Maybe I should put it this way. Like a juvenile court hearing, right? I mean, this is about treatment after all, and this is confidentiality, one's personal, the most intimate sort of personal things, and their medical records and so on and so forth. This is about treatment. Maybe the rule should be you close the hearing unless the person wants to waive that right, and/or counsel if they're not competent to make that choice, maybe, and open it. And maybe they could selectively open it, who they want to have there, you know, their friends and, you know, whatever. All right, so that's one point of view. Completely opposite point of view, this is a judicial proceeding, right? And people, this is the criminal justice system as the model, right? And people are being deprived of their liberty, and we have to have accountability for that. And if you're not going to, you know, we can't depend upon the lawyer and the client, you know, basically to do that. We need to expose it to sunlight. So, you know, criminal trials are open. They have to be open by not only the Sixth Amendment, but actually the First Amendment. The Supreme Court has said that you have to have access to judicial proceedings. Well, this should be like that. We should have access to the proceeding by the public, you know, and you've got two, obviously, very interesting points of view there, right? Well, our law doesn't say anything about this, right? And moreover, the laws of most states don't say anything about this. You can go look. And the ones that say something about it, some of them say this, and some of them say that, right? So this is very interesting why this is basically something that hasn't received systematic attention. And it goes back from the hearing, what about the records? Should you be able to get access to the records? The only reason that we know anything about the Cho case is because a reporter somehow had gotten word that something had happened in 2005 and went to the court and said, I understand that, you know, this kid was, you know, committed, you know, or there was a hearing held in, you know, December of 2005. I want the record. And the clerk looked and said, I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to do with this record. He kind of found the record and called the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court looked at the law, got the Attorney General's office to look at the law, and the best interpretation of the law was give it to him because it doesn't say anything, you know, about this. And this is all this private, you know, information, right? So we actually legislated about this, and I'll leave it to you to think about what we decided to do about it. All right, now, so I want to finish with the Healthcare Decisions Act. So, I've already indicated, I think advanced directives for mental health care can foster genuine empowerment and have powerful utility in this context. As compared, for example, with end-of-life decision-making, where one of the things, the standard sort of, you know, mantra is, they failed. And why have they failed? Because people don't want to think about that, right? They've never been dead before, they've never been almost dead before, and they don't know how they would think about being almost dead, right? So people don't want to think about it, and they don't know what they'd think if they did think about it. So nobody wants to do it, right? And so the push is to get them to do an agent. Right. Well, here is a situation where people have been there before and they do know what they think. Right? They have strong preferences about don't do this the way it was done the last time, or in retrospect, even though I said no before, I think you did the right thing. Right? And so they do have preferences and they can report these preferences. And therefore, here's a situation where advanced directives can make a big difference in effectuating autonomy. Right? So this is a good idea. The other context is advanced planning by patients and families in case of decline of cognitive capacity. Okay, it could be me, it could be Art, right, that we're having little memory problems right here. And, you know, I'm a little worried, given that I've had mild cognitive impairment, that it's going to get to be moderate cognitive impairment. And, you know, I do have preferences about what happens, right, later on. And forget end-of-life issues, just long-term care. You know, lots of issues that I have preferences about. And so here's a situation where we really ought to try to empower people to really think about these things. Forget dying. It's not about dying. It's about these other things. All right. So interestingly, so I had a task force on empowerment and self-determination. They opposed the idea of a standalone psychiatric advance directive. It's called a PAD, right? And there are 24 states that have adopted psychiatric advance directives law. So I didn't make this idea up. Obviously, it's an idea that has some traction that other people have seen also. So we wanted to see what its role in Virginia. Interestingly, our task force basically said, we don't want this to be a standalone law, you know, because, of course, this is not only about mental health care. If I lose decisional capacity, it's going to be other kinds of health care, too. This is only about psychiatric care. This is empowering people when they're not able to make decisions. Well, that's, you know, other people have that problem. It's not only people with mental illness. So this should be part of the Healthcare Decisions Act. We're trying to mainstream treatment of mental illness. We're not, you know, everything is not separate, or it's not supposed to be separate, right? So we need to put it in. That's a great idea, right? So we decided to amend the entire Healthcare Decisions Act. So the amendments allow instructional directives for all healthcare, basically, and try to empower people in those respects, not only life prolonging treatment. There are some specific innovations in this that will be of interest to anyone in bioethics, right? So we have advanced authorization for research participation, you know, in the statute. We have advanced authorization for nursing home and long-term care placement. We have advanced authorization for psychiatric hospitalization to try to stay out of the judicial process at all. People can say, you know, when I lose decisional capacity, you know, and right for the moment, just assume that they're not objecting. They just are not able to give informed consent. Right now, the law requires them to be committed. If you're not able to consent to voluntary hospitalization, it's a binary system. You have to be committed. You have to have the police. You have to have all this stuff. Well, we're getting rid of the police anyway, but there's no need to have a judge involved in this. Right? I mean, let's have the surrogate decision maker, you know, be able to make these decisions. So you can authorize psychiatric hospitalization. And then there are the Ulysses clauses, where people say, even if I object, you can treat me over my incompetent protest. So this is all in the statute. The key elements of the Ulysses clause, which is there's none of the other states that have advanced directives that have kind of got this specific about what this, you know, how this should be done. So obviously it doesn't involve withholding or withdrawing life prolonging procedures. We accepted that from this. Advanced directive has to explicitly state that the provisions of the advanced directive regarding the specific decision at issue should govern even over his later protest. So we want an indication that you've given specific thought to this, right? And the task force, you know, mainly consumer driven, was very insistent, right, that we don't want to have people have the law such that people, even though they haven't really given a lot of thought to it, the default was that they were having a Ulysses clause. No, you got to be specific about this. And indeed, the patient's attending physician or licensed clinical psychologist attested that the patient was capable of making an informed decision and understood the consequences. So we have, you know, contemporaneously documented kind of understanding. And if they do that, then they have a Ulysses clause, right, and can authorize treatment over protest. This applies also to admission to the hospital. Okay, so if it's one of those people, again, we don't expect this to happen very often, but it'd be interesting to see how often it actually happens when people actually do this. You know, my wife is going to be my designated decision maker, you can hospitalize me even over my objection, and I'll sign it and so on. Forget getting the courts in, you know, involved in this. So that's there also. So I think this is really accurate to say there is genuine enthusiasm. There has been so from the beginning as we kind of had a nice developmental process with this. And people, you know, maybe the psychiatrists and the clinicians that might be so worried that people are going to say no to everything and that, they don't like the idea of this. Turns out, you know, over time you talk about it and you go into it, you know, people get more comfortable with it. All the stakeholder groups, the hospitals, the, clinical groups, the CSBs, everybody thinks that this is a great idea. And I think partly for the rhetorical reasons that I mentioned before, but also I think actually, and I'll show you one slide about this, it actually works. Okay, there is the kind of a great study that was done by the team at Duke on studying the effects of these advanced directives. And they, I think, have shown that this actually does work. It reduces crises and it reduces the need for coercion when there are crises. So everybody thinks that this is a great idea. And now we have an opportunity because we've had all this run-up and you have all these people that say now that we've got this adopted, they want to do everything they can to encourage people to execute these advanced directives. So we need to get some, you know, phalanx out to provide training, to develop the forms, and then hopefully to measure, you know, the outcomes. So fortunately, we were able to get some money, not enough, but some money to actually study the implementation process. And part of the reason that this is, I think, attracted foundation funding is that a lot of these other advanced directive laws, they've been in force for a long time, but one of the issues, again, not unlike the end-of-life situation, is that it just doesn't seem to be happening very often. And one of the things that we've got going for us is that we have the facilities and the institutional, you know, providers that are interested in facilitating this, right? So, you know, you've got a lot of constituencies that want to see this happen. And so maybe we have a shot actually at, you know, actually showing, you know, a system-wide implementation, you know, of this. And I'm going to close with one irony, two ironies actually about this. So one is the form. So that's why I wanted this handout here. So I don't know if everybody got one. It's actually two forms. So why is it two forms? First, when we were developing it, it was one form. And it was, you know, who knows how many pages it was. This is, I think, our new form that is a combined form is four pages. I think it was like five or six, you know, pages. And basically everybody in the mainstream of healthcare didn't want all this mental health stuff in here, Ulysses clauses and stuff like that. It just made the form too long. If you hand it to somebody, you know, you're doing your patient education and, you know, you're basically saying, you know, people, you know, patient self-determination act requires these conversations. You give them the material, you say, read this, you know, overnight, and maybe you'll be able to, you know, whatever. Whatever we're trying to do to encourage people to do it, it made it longer and more complicated. And, you know, the chances that they're going to, oh, God, I don't want to do it, just forget it. Right, which is a good point. So we were basically now in tension with the general effort to implement advanced directives for ordinary health care, and certainly for end of life care, and our mental health thing. So what, you know, the idea here was to make this integrated, right? Well, not a good idea, right? So we had to disaggregate this. And so that's what we did. And so now we have the three-page form, which is the kind of the non-mental health form, although it says, if I have other things to tell you about my mental health care, it does have some of these provisions that I mentioned in here. And if I have anything to tell you about my mental health care that's not already in here, there's another form. And so they can do both. And we do have a combined one if they basically want to do it all from scratch. But there's also going to be a different facilitation process. There has to be the signature. That's another thing they didn't like. You know, they have to have the signature, you know, by the clinician on this one. Well, this one doesn't have to have that. Right? So what we did, and it took, you know, here, I mean, I'm a pretty high-priced talent, if you don't mind my saying it, to be drafting forms. But we spent a lot of time, you know, drafting these forms in order to basically to get this, you know, right. And so, you know, wanted to give you the benefit of seeing how we had to basically, you know, to do this. This one, the mental health one, in addition to the Ulysses Clause and all of that, also says if you have a crisis plan that has all the details of what you would like to have done, and these recovery-oriented crisis plans are being, you know, developed before these laws, but now it gives it effect, right? It says this actually can have legal effect. If you take your crisis plan appended to this, you know, it will have legal effect, right? So that's kind of where we went with this.
Those are handed out at hospitals?
So we have just finished. We're now, the Hospital Association is going to print them up and so on. We've just actually gotten this. And the reason that we were in such a hurry to get this done, I want to use them in the research. Right, so we're going to have a client-centered, you know, research study here, facilitation, and we want the form, the same form, to be used, you know, everywhere. So we were really anxious, and we have to spend the money by the end of 2010. So, you know, that's, you know, so this is now moving, and yes, this is not required. I mean, we don't have the authority to require anything, although what's kind of interesting, Virginia, I think, like many of the other states, has a form in the statute, right? We don't like that form. We have never liked that form. The Hospital Association and the Bar Association, you know, have the forms that hopefully will get out there into practice. So yes, the Hospital Association certainly will encourage, I think, their own, but they can vary it, obviously, for local reasons, they always have. You know, but we've involved them, of course, in the drafting of it. So we hope this will become a kind of standard of practice, you know, using this form. So final point. In getting this law adopted, we went through the code and tried to modify the Healthcare Decisions Act so that it would do what we wanted here, but that it would not touch end-of-life care. I mean, for reasons that everybody in this room can appreciate, we did not want to, this is Virginia also, we did not want to get involved in the politics of end-of-life care. And I asked the sponsor, the patron, the chief patron of the bill, to be, he's a right-wing Republican from, you know, Charlottesville, Alabama. And he's interested in mental health and was certainly in favor of the idea of advanced directives, but, you know, I knew you know, that it would be helpful to us to have him on our side, you know, on this end of life thing. And we tried to draft it very carefully so that we could say, if you were to do all the detailed review of a whole statute the way that we've done, you will see that we have not changed anything that bears on end of life decision making. And so we're moving forward in the statute, in the legislature. And there's one thing I forgot. In addition to the advanced directive parts, we took the occasion to solve another problem that I think everybody in this room probably that knows anything about the Healthcare Decisions Act is familiar with, which is the default list of surrogates for people who don't have advanced directives, which of course is most people, probably most people in this room do not have an advanced directive, and the statutes have basically avoided the need for guardianship and judicial intervention by having a default list of surrogates. Well, our surrogate list runs out after any blood relative. The Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act has a kind of anyone who's similar, who's properly situated, that knows the values of the person and so on. Okay, which is a very important thing, and it's a very important thing for people with mental illness because so many of them basically are living with peers and that's the persons that they're interested in, and maybe even certainly older people who, you know, getting older and they've outlived all their relatives, and, you know, or, to example that I used to use all the time to make the legislatures get the point here, the daughter-in-law is the one that's making all the decisions, right? Well, she hasn't got any status, you know, under this. Now, of course, you could designate the person, but if you haven't done it, you know, that person isn't going to be legally qualified, basically, to make these decisions. And, of course, it could be the next-door neighbor. I mean, it could be, so you obviously, we know that we need to do something about this, and so we took the occasion, since we were modifying the act, to do it. And, of course, the consumer community mental health, it's of course they need to, you know, want us to do this. So we put it, and I had not occurred to me when we did this, and I gave them these assurances, that the end of life, you know, argument would come up in this context. And it did, right? Because the Family Foundation and some, you know, said, what is this? You know, and I thought you said this didn't have anything to do with end of life care. And this was on a fast track to go through, and you called me up. And I said, oh, well, you know, I'm sorry, but that's, you know. And so we then end up with a very sort of intense sort of period of time where this got to the House floor, and because there was something that we had modified to make the form in the statute conform to the language that we were using in the act, healthcare decisions, basically. We had modified the word in the form. The form itself, then, was fair game. And so you had this debate going on in the life floor about what should be the default rule, right, for end-of-life decision-making. And if you, the person hasn't said anything, we're just going to do it all. Right? And that's what they were arguing for, and we got caught up in the politics of end-of-life care, notwithstanding every effort that we had tried to avoid doing it, and it was being held hostage. Our bill was being held hostage, you know, to this, and we kept trying to come up with, you know, different, you know, language and kept offering things, and finally, you know, it got down to, you know, the conference committee. It was unanimously passed just the way we wanted in the Senate, and, you know, came out of the House with this, you know, end-of-life stuff in it. And, you know, our position was we would rather the bill went down, right, than have that in there. So forget it, right? And he actually, my legislator would try other people on the group, you know, do you agree with Professor Bonnie on this? Right, and of course they all agreed, we talked about it. And finally we got the bill, right? But they had stripped all these provisions, and we said, we'll accept stripping the provisions on the default surrogates. So we're back in the legislature right now with the default surrogate, you know, bill, and I'm, you know, I don't know what will happen. But, you know, and there were good process reasons to put that off. I mean, it had not gotten the airing probably that it deserved. We were on the fast track with all this because of expertise, right? I mean, the experts have come up with this, and they were, everybody was, you know, testifying in favor of it. So they weren't looking at it very carefully. This other thing obviously deserved a little bit more attention. So we'll see what, you know, happens this session. So that's what I did for my summer vacation. Where are we?
So you get about 10 minutes.
Okay. All right, so which of those many issues does anyone, you know, since you're imprisoned here, want to talk about?
Question about the advanced directives and any potential health literacy issues, given a lot of population.
The forms and stuff.
Right, so how well would they be educated in what to include on the form and to understand what they're agreeing to?
Okay. So it's a very good question. And one thing that we did try to do is to get people to kind of put the thing through reading levels and, you know, that sort of thing. We have apparently, I mean, I think it is being pre-tested, you know, in various population groups now, but it's not being done as systematically as your question implies that it should be done. And I think we will have an opportunity, at least with regard to the mental health constituency, once we, you know, at least we'll have something, because we really need to get it out there, that we are going to do a study, you know, a facilitation study with, you know, 75 or 100 people, you know, who are in the facilitation group, and, you know, another 75 or 100 that are in a control group, and, you know, they will all have the opportunity to do this. One will just have the guidance and facilitation, and the other will be on their own, you know, to do it. And we'll see. Another thing that's interesting, actually, in terms of the facilitation effort, once you're out of the lab, you know, an experimental study like was done at Duke, and you're actually now trying to show that if you actually do this in practice, you know, what will happen, we're going to try to vary, stratify our group so that some of the people are actually being guided by the services system in whatever way the services system would try to assign people to help do this in the ordinary routine service. We'll also have community support, you know, peer support activities that have nothing to do with the services system, but that will basically peer educators and people who have been in Virginia, it's the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, the WRAP plan, that they trained people to do these things, and those WRAP trainers will then be trained to do this, and then they will do that, and we'll have a chance to get some data, I think, about understanding from that. And thirdly, there's one of the people from Mental Health America, you know, who is, you know, really doggedly interested in this, that's actually put a computer-assisted, you know, thing tied to Virginia law, kind of, you know, and it's great, actually. I looked at it, and, you know, and he's done a really, really good job. So we'll actually have that for the people who are computer literate, you know, to see what happens with that. So I think we'll have some information, but the answer to your question is we haven't done a whole lot, you know, up until now.
Yep. Your commission was established in 2005, and the tragedy happened 2 years later. What changed?
Well, the commission was kicked off. The idea was announced to the public at a conference that we held in December 2005. Then in the summer of 2006, we had this long planning effort, developmental effort that I mentioned to you. The actual first meeting of the commission and the task forces was in October of 2006. So we were only about 6 months into our work when the tragedy happened. And as I said, at that point, we had a 2-year plan that we were working on. But as soon as that happened, we had to have something to go to the General Assembly in December of 2006. And so we accelerated the work in order to get these commitment recommendations and get the bills prepared and so on and so forth. But that meant delaying, you know, and further, I mean, all the task forces were still doing the work that they had been set out to do. So then, you know, we had all the task force reports were basically done sometime in 2008. And then we put together our legislative program for December 2008, adopted in 2009, and now we're moving to 2010. I mean, was that the, so that was the timing of this. We didn't have time to do the comprehensive effort, and then we did. We got run over by the recession. I mean, you know, it was just, so there's no money, and we probably lost the money that was put into the system. You know, $42 million was put into the system, you know, by the legislature in you know, early 2008. That's gone. So this is, it's too bad. You know, I mean, I just don't know. All we can do is to try to leave in place, and we've actually, we put a progress report out last month in which we basically said, here is the sequence when there is money that the investments need to be made, you know, in the system. Priority number one, crisis stabilization. Priority number two, increase outpatients, you know, in more intensive, you know, other alternatives for urgently needed care and so on. Also, we're trying to provide an integrated system. We now have two systems. We have the hospital system and we have the community system. And there's the incentives are just not, you know, where they should be. And so we want to try to integrate the system in order basically to have the, you know, the services, the money go to the services that, you know, provide the best you know, outcomes. So we're trying to put all that in place, but you know, God knows when there'll be money, you know, for the legislature to do anything about this, unless we can close some of those facilities and get that money into the community. You know, that's, I think, probably the most likely thing to happen. Is that where you were going with your question?
Yeah, that, I think, and also just your initial reaction to that. I mean, how did it, the next time, you know, did you have an emergency meeting right after that? I mean, what was just the...
Well, we already had the task forces at work. I mean, what's so interesting about this is we really were already doing this. I mean, and focusing on this outpatient commitment problem, the commitment criteria problem, and our commitment task force, the press was already on it because you have the usual fights, right? And so they were covering it. And, you know, then, of course, we had to accelerate and we had to bring things that were at that point percolating, and, you know, get them to make recommendations, go up to the commission, have the commission make its recommendations and get it all done, you know. So I accelerated the meetings and, you know, we kind of got it done, I think, by no end of November and put the bill together in December. You know, basically the governor and the leadership of, you know, both houses kind of all got, you know, around the bill. And that clearly, it might have been that we would have had a consensus bill that it would have gone through. We would not have had that level of political commitment if it had not been for the tech. Yeah.
Can you clarify what would happen if I said in my specifically direct, I do not receive the following mental health care, and
uh-huh.
I write in there, I don't want to receive any antipsychotic medications,
yeah.
And in fact, I need them.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the, you know, the issue, of course, most people are worried about. And so the answer is the advance directive cannot trump the commitment process. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. You can't, clearly, under the law as it was worded last year, it refers specifically to admission. And so you cannot say, I don't want to be admitted to a hospital. The issue, the law as it is written, unfortunately, despite what I thought was clear, seems to some people not to be so clear with regard to the refusal of medication. And so we're going to clarify it, but we're going to clarify it so that basically whatever the constitutional rules are, and the other rules of Virginia law that govern the right to refuse treatment before advance directives were ever heard of, are going to apply. At a minimum, if it's an emergency. That everyone agrees on. If it's an emergency situation and person needs the antipsychotic drugs, you can give it to them not only over their current objection, but over their prior objection, okay, if it's a current emergency. Where the ambiguity is, you know, if it's not non-emergent, but, you know, from a paternalistic standpoint, people think that they really do need it and so on and so forth. And there's probably some dispute about what current law is about that, but whatever current law is would apply.
If it's not clear in the legislature and it's not clear to you,
yes.
It certainly won't be clear on the ground.
Well, we're going to make it so. So one of the issues here is, so I have tried, given the fact that there is no other source of authority,
right.
As I said before, we have tried to be the source of authority. So when the commitment criteria were changed, and people say, well, what is substantial risk of, substantial probability of harm to another in the near future? What the hell does that mean, right? So we did a 20-page document, right, that says, here's some situations, this is what we think it means, right? And so I know they're using it out there in the field, right? I mean, so we don't have any decisional law, but we have, you know, a paper, right, that we've done that we posted on the website. And my attempt all along has been to get the Attorney General's office and the others that have any authority say what the law is on the same page. So all of us are on the same page, and frankly, I have acceded, frankly, to their view that right now the human rights regulations would govern in that situation, and the human rights regulations are very specific, basically, that says it uses a substituted judgment sort of, you know, standard in those circumstances if it's not an emergency. And my feeling is I don't think I would have written it that way. It wasn't the way that actually that I wrote it way back in the 1980s. Because I used the deterioration definition of emergency. Emergency is much narrower now, and that's the way it is. So we will, in fact, put out the rules, you know, using that interpretation. Yeah.
I was wondering, part of the reforms I went through, I followed you with the civil commitment, but I was thinking about the whole problem of criminalization of the mentally ill.
Yeah, well, I didn't talk much about
it. Right,
that.
And that's what I was wondering if you looked at, if Virginia is also looking at diversion programs.
Oh, of course.
To
So one of the things, first of all, there's, you know, mainly this is about money. Okay, it is mainly about putting money so that you can implement the diversion programs and get people out of the criminal justice system. It's about information sharing too, so there are some legal sort of issues that will come up. Some portion, I think $6 million of that $42 million that the legislature appropriated in 2008 was put into diversion programs. And so what we insisted on then is that there be an evaluation, you know, component to this, so that when we could go back to the legislature and say, see, the things that were done, you know, specific 10 programs have been funded with this, and they're all collecting data, analogous data. We've had Hank Steadman and, you know, all the people that have done all that work, you know, come and help us design the evaluation package for this. So we will, we do in fact have data, you know, that is emerging, and that will be, again, if money, it's about money, so I just don't know what's happening in the General Assembly now. We're trying to keep the level of money that we already have to kind of keep this going. The mental health courts is an issue, and we proposed, you know, the Chief Justice was initially against it, as a lot of Chief Justices are. They don't like the idea of fractionating courts and having, you know, a court for, you know, a diabetes and a court for, you know, every disease of the month or every problem of the month, and I understand that. But over time, he kind of came around and is not opposed to this. So we have actually got a mental health court, you know, bill, you know, as well. But I think that's not as important as actually, you know, putting the money. People have the discretion to do this, you know, now. And another important part, frankly, of the criminalization issue, I could have mentioned because we did do something about this, is having the police have a place to take people before they arrest them. And so these drop-off, basically drop-off centers, crisis stabilization sort of drop-off centers that they can take people, and they don't have to wait. They basically just go there and drop them off, and they, no questions asked. You know, people will take them, and if they need to be in custody, they'll, you know, will use the civil commitment process. If they don't, as many times, you can talk people, you know, down, and they won't need it. If we could create those facilities, we have the authority in the law that we put in 2008. You know, to create these drop-off centers and have them licensed to take custody under those circumstances. So the law, the legal authority is now there. The question is the money, right, to create those capabilities. I think that is a really important thing. If we could kind of just make that the practice, we could keep a lot of these people out of the jails.
Last one, yeah, one more.
How do you plan to measure the success of the reforms?
How do you measure success?
Yeah, is there a plan to study it, or I guess?
Yes. Did you see my slide in this? Has it flashed by?
No.
Well, there's a slide.
Okay.
Right? You know, let's see if I can just prove it to you. I think it's here somewhere. This is all the data from the Duke study, but at the very, very end. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have to do this there. You know. How do we measure success? So we're gonna. Hopefully, we put the data in place. As I said, reducing the number of TDOs is a really good measure of success, because a lot of the things that I've talked about will sort of translate into that. So I want to make the use of coercion in all of its manifestations a performance measure for the system. And we now, as I said, we have the data actually to be able to do that, which we certainly didn't have in 2006. You know, obviously there are other more traditional sort of, you know, clinical measures of effectiveness, but from my standpoint, you know, I think this would probably be a pretty good one. Obviously with the criminalization, you know, obviously the, you know, the use of the, and then you would have subsidiary measures. The use of the drop-off centers obviously would be a measure, you know, as well, because it all translates into whether you're using the TDOs and, you know, the hospitalization process. But also, I think the, you know, there are other things that we could come up with basically as indicators. Advanced directives, actually measuring, you know, given the fact that having advanced directives, as you will see from this other study, I mean, you know, is also a pretty good, you know, predictor that you will reduce crises and reduce coercion attributable or associated with them. We've done jail census, you know, and we should do that every annually, right, or something like that, to kind of see about the, you know, so I think we could actually create them, you know. But as I said, I think we're set up for failure right now because we just haven't been able to do much about the services. We can try to change attitudes, you know, and there may be things that even that will, you know, would help with,
and change the practice even using the resources that you now have. But at the end of the day, I mean, we've just got to create these
right.
alternatives.
I can't help but notice that the call for a place to bring people by the police, no questions asked, it really could be part of a bigger picture, just like the advanced directives. You could have people turning in guns that they don't want, children that they don't want, and mentally the people brought to the same place that they have an interesting mix. Maybe that's called Walmart.
Do I have to endorse maybe, all those suggestions?
Maybe it's Walmart. Anyway,
actually, the idea came from yes. a place in Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, I know,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. And we haven't come down. And, yeah.
Right. But I want to thank you for that great talk.
Well, you can see, I don't mind talking about this.
No,
I'm kind of in the throes of it.
And maybe we'll take a minute or two if you want to ask Professor Barney something privately, and then I got to move on to dinner.
Okay. Oh, you got it. Okay.
I wanted to ask you, when you're looking at implementation, and you're just looking at the filling out of the forms.
Yeah, well.
That's the hard part.
Well,